Linda Hughes, and we have Tim sharing about some lessons from Tim's life in the military, which has spanned well over 30 years. But let's go back to where it all began. And was it Pennsylvania? Could you describe that period of your life?
I was born in August of 1941, right before we went into war after Pearl Harbor in December. And I was born in the middle of the state in Wilkes-Barre. And when the war started, my father quit teaching, went down and went in the Navy. And I didn't see very much of him for the next 4 or 5 years. So my mother moved down with her parents in a small town, Everett, Pennsylvania, small rural town of about 2,000 people. And that's where I was raised as a mommy's boy for my first 4 or 5 years of my life. Saw my dad occasionally. He would come back on a leave status, and we went to Miami once and saw him, went to Boston once. We saw him once in New York over Christmas. So that was really how my life started out. And of course, as a young kid, you don't remember a whole lot about that. And I was telling somebody the other day, one of the things that I remember more than anything else is that every night, my mother read to me. And my favorite book were 4 books written by Richard Halliburton. And Richard Halliburton traveled the world, and he would go from place to place, and then he would write about it. And these were always fascinating to me because he would always do interesting things everywhere he went. He'd ride a camel, or he'd swim someplace where you probably weren't supposed to be swimming, and he'd be in boats and things. It was always fascinating to me. So that's where I was, and then I was an only kid. Up until my dad got back from the war, and then my brother became a war baby, and he's 5 years younger than I, and he also is a retired Navy captain. We are totally different. I'm a very analytical person. He speaks 7 languages fluently, and that's what he did in the Navy. He was kind of a spy, and I get along somewhat in English, but I can balance my checkbook, and he has a problem. So we are different, but we're still very best of friends. And my mom and dad lived, they both died within 2 weeks of one another in 2000 after being married for 66 years.
Wow.
So my family basically was, we lived in Pennsylvania until the Korean War. My dad was recalled. We went to Gainesville, Florida, where he took over command of the Naval Reserve Training Center in Gainesville, Florida. And we were there for about 2.5 years. And that's where I started Boy Scouts. I was a very successful Boy Scout. If I'm not the youngest, I may be to this day the youngest Eagle Scout in the United States. I made an Eagle just about the time I was 13. And I got into a troop that was just fascinating to me in Florida, and got to do an awful lot of stuff with the Boy Scouts. And I think if there is a lesson to be learned about my young life, when I was in 7th grade, I knew that I wanted to go to the Naval Academy. The Naval Academy fascinated me, and about that time, the serial Men of Annapolis was on television. It went for about 2 years, and every week we would watch Men of Annapolis, and it just fascinated me, some of the things that they said on that show. And I've tried to get a couple of those shows for the Naval Academy Alumni Association, and believe it or not, the university that owns the rights are the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And they're not willing to give them up. So it's been an interesting hunt. So I knew a long, long time ago that I wanted to be a naval officer. I was a very good athlete and a very good student in high school. I stood number 2 in a class of 189, and I was all-state in football, baseball, and basketball, which helped me get in the Naval Academy because they were very interested in me to get down there and play football and baseball and basketball. So that, I guess, when you're in seventh grade and you have three things you want to do, you want to go to the Naval Academy, you want to play football for the Naval Academy, and you want to fly jet airplanes. And I got to do all three of those. So if you dream as a seventh grader, you should continue to dream and pursue your dreams. And none of those dreams will come true if you can't be a good citizen and a good student. You don't have to be a great athlete, but you do have to be a good citizen and a good student.
Of course, the scouting helped that. But that also took, at that time, a congressional appointment, too? Was that still the mode?
That was the mode. Very interesting to share with you how things have changed a bit. I got an appointment coming out of high school. But the Naval Academy looked at my SAT scores, and I had about a 720 in math, and I had about a 450 in English. Even though I stood number one in my class in English, tells you how they taught in Pennsylvania in those days. So the Naval Academy said, maybe you ought to go to a year of prep school. So they sent me down to Admiral Farragut Academy in Pine Beach, New Jersey, right outside of Toms River. And I went down there for a year, and they managed to get me another appointment, and that's how I got in the Naval Academy.
So it was your English skills that needed a little bit of work?
Well, interesting enough, in my high school, we never studied vocabulary. And if you'll remember the old SAT, the Scholastic Aptitude Test, there was always two or three big sections in there on word analogies and word definitions. And I wasn't too good in either one of those. And I wasn't a very good writer because we didn't do a lot of writing either. But I got much better. When I went to prep school, I took one math course and seven English courses, so I got a little better.
So later on, now looking back, that must have been frustrating then, but was that a wise thing to have happened? As an officer later, you needed those communication skills.
As I look back at it, it was a good thing and a bad thing. The good thing was that the Naval Academy at the time could not redshirt an athlete. So here comes these kids out of high school at 17 years old, and we're playing against guys that are 19, 20. We hadn't matured physically, and we hadn't matured emotionally or mentally. So that year, I think, played a good part for me. The bad part was that when I got up to captain, they were trying to make admirals out of captains that were 46, 47, 48 years old. That extra year put me up on the upper levels of that age group. You wouldn't think about it at the time. It's like when you take a job, is the first thing in your mind, what's my retirement benefits going to be? Well, you don't think about the things down at the other end that could be very important as you get down at the other end. So in that regard, it probably hurt me a little bit, but I think all in all, it was the best thing for me.
So you made a conscious decision then after high school, and you immediately went through these stages, the preparatory and the academy. Then what happened?
Well, then I went down to the Naval Academy, and interesting for me was that Admiral Farragut was a military school. So I had worn a uniform and learned to shine my shoes and keep a uniform straight and all that kind of stuff for a year. And now I'm at the Naval Academy with a bunch of people coming directly out of high school. So shining their shoes and brushing off their uniform and washing clothes and doing all these things was new to them. It wasn't new to me. I knew how to do that. And plebe year at the Naval Academy is a hard year. They keep you running around and answering questions and doing things that a normal college freshman doesn't do. So the better you are prepared for that year, the easier that year seems to be. So I thought the year was pretty easy. I was just amazed at the first day of football season. And while we were there in plebe summer, you come in the summer and you stay there for 2 months in July and August waiting for the brigade to come back. So you can fit right in. You know how to march and you know how to do all the things, and you're not like a doofus just walking around. But I was an all-state football center, And in the first day of football practice, we had 23 centers, of which 9 of them had been all-state in some state. So you find out real quickly that there's some other athletes out across the United States that you're not used to competing against.
Wow. So you went through straight through the 4 years of the Naval Academy, and then what was the first assignment?
First assignment I had, and the way they assign them in the Naval Academy, they put all the assignments that are available up on a great big board. And the person that stands number one in their class goes in and gets the pick of any of all these billets. And if you stand last in your class, you don't get much pick. There's not a whole lot left. I stood somewhere around the middle of my class, I guess, and I got Naval Aviator. So right after I graduated, I went to Pensacola and started flight training in July of 1964.
Did you choose your specialty?
No, you go through flight training, and how well you do down there depends on where you go. You have some choice, but the Navy also knows that they need so many fighter pilots, attack pilots, prop pilots, helicopter pilots. So it's really needs of the service in the long run.
And did you get more or less what you felt good about then?
I wanted to go into anti-submarine warfare, and I ended up, because I wanted to go, I put a statement down I should have never put down there. I said, I want to go where the action is. Now this is, I graduated in November of 1964. And if you'll remember back in that time frame, things are fairly quiet in the world. And then in December came the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And next thing you know, they've assigned me to a seaplane squadron that will go to Vietnam because they didn't have enough runways. And they would put us in the lakes and rivers and all the various places. So that's where I ended up going.
Start out with seaplanes then.
Seaplanes.
Then, but I remember reviewing your background. You eventually were on carrier, but were you flying off of carrier, or that was just...
Now the seaplane, I started out when we home based in the Philippines, and then we would take 4 airplanes and we'd fly them to Vietnam, and we would bring a seaplane tender into Cam Ranh Bay, which is in the middle of Vietnam, in the middle of South Vietnam. They would put 4 buoys in the water, and we would tie up to a buoy and live on the airplane. There were 13 of us. We had 13 beds on the airplane. We had a galley that we could do our own cooking. And we would get to go off the plane onto the ship once or twice a week to get a shower. And the rest of the time, we lived on the airplane. And they would bring out meals to us by a boat. And we would cook our meals and eat out there and sit on the wings and eat them. It was kind of interesting.
And you were waiting for what?
What we did about every other day, 2 of the airplanes would take off. We'd fly down around Vietnam, all around the coast, over by Cambodia. Then we'd go out to sea about 20 or 30 miles, go up to the Gulf of Tonkin, come back down to Cam Ranh Bay. It was about a 15-hour flight. And our job was to do surveillance on the shipping from the shore out to 20 miles. And basically, we were looking for people running guns, doing that kind of thing. So we would report all those, and they kept track of all the ships that were close to them, and they would try to find out what they were doing.
Were there any close calls during that time?
Almost every time we came back, we had at least some bullet holes in the hull because we were big and slow. I tell you, we have 13 people, so you can imagine it was a big airplane. It only went about 120 miles an hour. So we're lumbering through the sky, and night was the worst because we would shine spotlights on ships. Of course, now we're the target up there and just shoot at us. We never got hit by any missiles, or we never got hit by any big guns, but we got hit by regular old rifles. And of course, what you would have to do after you landed, you'd have to go down in the bilges of the seaplane to make sure that you weren't going to flood and sink. So we would, there'd be maybe a bullet hole or 2 bullet holes, and you'd take a little plug and put in there and put some some tape around it and stuff. It was truly McHale's Navy.
So the 13 on board, now you were a pilot for that?
Actually, I was what we called a naval flight officer. And I have 20/30 vision, my left eye. The time I was at the Naval Academy, it was 20/20 vision to be a pilot, or you could not be a pilot, period. So they formed a new group of people that would be bombardier navigators, tactical coordinators, radar intercept officers, navigators, and we called this group Naval Flight Officers. So we went through flight training just like the pilots. We did all that kind of stuff. We just didn't have to fly the airplane. So I was one of those guys, and I would navigate around the coast and do all this kind of stuff. And if you'd ever see a submarine, I was in charge of running how we went out to find the submarine.
Yep. So a lot of people were observers then, or everybody had some role?
Everybody had some role.
Right.
Yeah, we had, of course, you have your mechanics and things on board that have to fix things when they break. You have somebody that's a radar operator. You have somebody that's an electronics operator. You have a couple ordnance men. You have a flight engineer. You have people who are trained in anti-submarine warfare specialties to do things that can run the radar so they could have some time off and time on. Like I say, our missions were 12 to 15 hours. So,
how many years were you on this assignment?
Well, I went over there in October of 65, and I came back in March of 65. And I went back over in August of 65 and stayed till March of 66. Then we came back and the Navy said, we're going to get rid of the seaplanes. They're antiquated. And so I moved to Moffett Field, which is north of San Francisco. And I transitioned to the P-3. Now this was an anti-submarine warfare airplane, had about the same crew, but it had four propellers instead of two on a seaplane, flew higher, was pressurized, a Lockheed Electra is what it was. So I did that transition in about a year, and then found myself back in Vietnam in the P-3. Got there in February and I left in October. And at that time, I got selected. I was the first NFO to be selected to go to test pilot school. It was all pilots up until this time. And that was in Patuxent River, Maryland. So that's where I went after I was finished my third tour in Vietnam.
And you were testing what there?
I tested weapon systems. It was an ideal time to go there for an anti-submarine warfare guy because they just put brand new sensors in the P-3. And we started out with the P-3A, then we went to the P-3B, and this was the P-3C. And everything inside was state-of-the-art things for looking for Soviet submarines. So I got to do all the testing and all the evaluation of the P-3C. At the same time, they had found out that the Soviet Union had a submarine that followed all aircraft carriers. And the way things were set up was, if the balloon goes up, the submarine shoots all its missiles and tries to sink the aircraft carrier. Get that aircraft carrier out of the way. So the Navy said, you know what we need? We need a squadron of anti-submarine warfare airplanes on each carrier to keep track of that submarine and look around and find submarines and do surveillance around the carrier. That airplane was called the S-3A Viking. Now, while I was at Patuxent River, after I went through test pilot school, graduated from test pilot school, then I went to weapons systems test at Patuxent River and was there for 2.5 years. We put all the stuff that was going to go in the S-3 in an A-3 airplane and tested it. So we really designed it and tested it. And when I left Patuxent River, I was the most knowledgeable person of the S-3 avionics of anybody in the Navy, because I had spent 2.5 years of flying this stuff, testing it, developing it, putting it in an airplane, doing all this kind of thing. So that led me now to my first carrier. Not right now, but
getting closer.
It comes time. They had a special airplane that used to be top secret that I helped build and test. And this one had super duper sensors on it that could find things off submarines that they don't even talk about today. So this was in a P-3. That's the airplane that I had flown in Vietnam the last time. And we developed this airplane and flew it, and every time we got a Soviet submarine, the crew that I had trained and I left and went to find this submarine. So we had a lot of on-top time on Soviet submarines. And I was supposed to take this crew that I trained and go to a VP squadron. That's the VP stands for patrol, in Patuxent River. I had orders and everything. And while I am debriefing somebody in the Pentagon, a bunch of admirals, about this special airplane, the chief of naval personnel walked in and said he needed to talk to me after the meeting. Well, I'm a lieutenant, and you know, you don't have a lot of admirals that are running around trying to talk to you. So you say, what did I do? I must be parked in the wrong spot or something. So he got me aside and he said, we have a special deal for you. And I said, I'd heard about special deals. I have to be somewhat careful of special deals. We want you to go down and become the aide to Commander Second Fleet. And he is the NATO admiral for all sea forces if NATO ever gets attacked. So it's a very good position, and we need you to go down there. And I said, but I'm going to the squadron with this airplane. They said, no, we want you to go down there. I had to volunteer for that, which after talking to a number of people, I did. So I ended up down in Norfolk. My airplane went to somebody else who hadn't even flown in it, and they did something with it. So I got down there, and being an aide to a three-star admiral is interesting because he really relies on you to tell him where to go and make sure he gets there and make sure that he's packing right to go on trips and all this kind of stuff. So I did that for 2.5 years. I went through 3 different 3-star admirals. Very interesting. I mean, I learned a lot. And then I got orders to the 1st S-3 squadron. The first one was in San Diego in 1973. So I went out to San Diego and became the training officer in that squadron. So now I'm ready to get into carrier aviation at 10 years after I graduated from the Naval Academy.
And what's an S-3? Could you describe that?
Well, an S-3 is, its nickname is the Viking. Made by Lockheed. 4-place airplane. They have 2 turbofan jets on it. It goes about 400 to 450 miles an hour, and it is totally, the back part of it that's looking for the submarine is totally controlled by a central computer. The radar is controlled by a central computer. Everything that's back there looking for submarines is controlled. All the data goes into a computer. It does its magic blah, 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 stuff and tells you, oh yeah, there's a submarine over there. And so when I got out there, as you remember, I told you that when I left Patuxent River 2.5 years ago, I was the expert. Well, I still was. So everybody was very interested in me. Everybody wanted me to come to their squadron and talk about the S-3. So I got rather busy. And then we found out we were going to make the first deployment of the S-3 on the John F. Kennedy in Norfolk. We were in San Diego. So we had to fly to Norfolk and do our workups, and then we'd come back to San Diego. And then we deployed to the Mediterranean in 1974. It was the first deployment for the S-3, the Viking, the F-14, the Tomcat, and the E-2C, which was the new super spy bird that has the big roof on top. And their job was to clear radius around the carrier of 250 miles, so they could see all the ships, all the airplanes, everything. So we went to the Med with all these brand new airplanes. So it's kind of an interesting deployment because everybody, Army, Navy, Air Force, everybody was interested in how well we would do since it was the first deployment for these airplanes. So that was my introduction to carrier aviation.
And did you spot some Soviet submarines?
Oh, we did. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the airplane had many problems. It was delivered on time, on cost, but the back end of it was state of the art, and very few of the enlisted people were able to fix it when it broke. There was a dearth of parts. I mean, you can expect this in the initial of anything. And so we struggled that deployment. We kept the airplanes in the air, but many times we'd get in the air, we'd have a partial system, computer wasn't working quite right, these type of things. It was the growing pains of a brand new airplane that was very, very sophisticated, more sophisticated than anything the Navy had ever seen. So it made it a little bit hard, but we got through it, and it got better and better and better as the time went on.
But you stayed in aviation then, all the rest of your time, or?
No, I came back and I went to an air wing staff. Now, on an aircraft carrier, you have 10 squadrons, and those 10 squadrons are shore-based all over the United States. And now it comes time for the carrier to go to sea. They all fly out to the carrier and bring their people out. They all go aboard the carrier, and we do whatever we're doing on a carrier. If it's a deployment, we go for 6 months. If it's a workup, maybe 2 weeks. And they fly back off to their home. But somebody is in charge of all 10 of those squadrons when they're on the aircraft carrier. And he is called the Air Wing Commander. Well, I went to work. I was, by this time, a lieutenant commander. So I went to work as the operations officer for Carrier Air Wing 9, which was on the USS Constellation. So I did that, and while I was doing that, I screened to be the commanding officer of an S3 squadron. Now, in aviation, you have 4 screens. Your first one is as a commander for your first squadron. Then if you do okay there, so let's say we have 100 people. Probably 70 people will screen for a command. Then the second one is for either the XO of an aircraft carrier or an air wing commander or a RAG commander. Now, RAG means ready air group. You know, if I've been out of an airplane for a long time, I went on shore duty for a 2-year period, now I come back to the fleet, they have to retrain me in my airplane before I go to my squadron. So the RAG does that, the ready air group does that. So you look for one of those 3. I screened for XO of an aircraft carrier. After XO of an aircraft carrier, then you start to get looked at for ships. And you look for what we call a deep draft ship, a big ship. And if you do well there, you're looked at for either an aircraft carrier or an amphibious assault ship, one of those 2 big ships. So if you do all 4 of those, of the 100 people you started with, about 4 or 5 will end up getting all 4 of those screens. So I went, I screened for VS-38, which was at, now VS, that stands for Anti-Submarine Squadron, meaning that it's on the carrier as opposed to VP, patrol is on the land, maritime patrol. I screened for VS-38. I was the first NFO to screen for an S3 squadron. And I got through that. We did very well. And it came time after we'd been I deployed on Constellation again. The interesting part of my deployment was we went to the Indian Ocean for the deployment. And we used to keep a carrier just south of Iran. That's when Iran was kind of doing about the same stuff they're doing now. And we just always wanted to make sure things were going okay. So we kept a carrier down there. And you'd launch almost every day. We'd launch 12-hour flight ops, go from noon to midnight. Then we'd go refuel the carrier somewhere. And then we'd keep doing this day after day after day after day. We were there for about 3 months, 2.5 months. But one of the things that came about was that they decided that they needed to go to Diego Garcia occasionally because we would get people coming over to us, and they weren't going in the Persian Gulf and the Middle East. They were going to Diego Garcia. That was about a 3 or 3.5 hour flight from the carrier. So the only plane we had that could do that was the S-3. So they decided we were going to take two of our S-3s, we had 10, and move them to Diego Garcia and form a detachment down there. Well, what was interesting at that point in time, this was 1980, and we were, if you'll remember, it was the end of the Carter administration. Inflation was sky high, and the Navy was having a heck of a time keeping people in the Navy because there were a lot of good-paying jobs out there because there was a lot of money and high interest and all this kind of thing. So I left. I was supposed to have 29 chiefs, and I had four. And in an airplane like the S-3, when you don't have all your maintenance people, it makes it real hard. Now I had to split my squadron somewhat to get down to Diego Garcia and form another detachment, which was very, very hard. I mean, we worked extremely hard to make sure that it was safe and we could get people back and forth and do all this. So that was an interesting challenge. Well, I got back and we had our change of command. The day I had my change of command was August 9th, 1981. Now, I can always remember that because that just happens to be my birthday. And on that day, I stood up there when I gave my farewell speech, and I said, today, and only today, I can honestly say that I am a 4-0 sailor in the United States Navy. It was true. I was 40. And then from there, I went to Ranger. And I spent 3 years on Ranger. I started out as the operations officer because they needed an operations officer, and I had experience. And then I went to the XO for the last 2 years.
XO stands for?
Executive Officer. It's the number two guy on the carrier. Now, on Ranger, you have 5,500 people. That's with the air wing on there. There's really about 2,500 ships company, and there's about 3,000 air wing people that come aboard when we all get together. We have room for about 5,800 people. We have beds for about 5,800 people. And of course, an aircraft carrier is a floating city with an airport on the roof. And being the executive officer, you're the guy that really makes all this happen. The commanding officer is in charge. He signs papers. He makes decisions. But the guy that's making all the department heads do things is the executive officer. Very challenging job. Very, very challenging. And I learned something about management when I got to the executive officer job. When I was in a squadron and in charge of a squadron and all those type things, I could do almost all the jobs by myself. If I were the operations officer of a squadron and we needed to do something and the ensigns and the JGs that worked for me or the lieutenants couldn't do it, I could say, okay, well, you guys go on home, I'll finish it, and I could take care of it myself. When I got to the aircraft carrier, there were 29 department heads, and there was no chance, none whatsoever. If you had a 48-hour day, you wouldn't have had enough time to do all this. So consequently, I really learned how to manage. It was my first very rude awakening of management techniques. And we deployed on Ranger, had a deployment, then it went in the yards for 13 months. Very good yard period, excellent yard period.
That was in the Northwest?
That was in Puget Sound. And I'm up there as a bachelor, and my wife now, Mary, was down here as a bachelorette, And she used to come up and see me. We had an I-5 relationship going. And right at the end of my tour up there, the 13 months, we got married. We moved her from Portland to Bremerton in a snowstorm. 2 months later, we put her on Ranger and moved her to San Diego. 3 months later was my time to rotate, so we moved to Washington, D.C. So in 4.5 months, she had been married to me and moved 4 times. So that was her introduction to the Navy.
And what does rotate mean?
That means that you go to another command. You know, normally your commands, not to a command, but to another organization. And in the Navy, what that means is about every 3 years, we change commands. So you go somewhere else. I went to the Pentagon. So this was my first try in the Pentagon. And the Pentagon was hard for me. I was a Navy captain by this time. And the Pentagon speaks a different language. It's just different. I had never been a bureaucrat. I'd always been an operator. And I found that the Pentagon was not a place I really enjoyed. But while I was there, I screened for my first ship command, which was the USS Ogden. It was an LPD. We had about 850 people on board, and we carried about 850 Marines. So about 1,700 people on there. So that was the first time I got to do my ship stuff. But they took me from the Pentagon, lucky for me, and sent me up to Newport to a 7-month course that they call a senior officer's maintenance and operating course. I called it Aviator Stupid Study. There were 5 Navy captains. We sat in the back row with a bunch of commanders that were ship drivers, had driven ships all their life. We hadn't done that. I mean, I'd come as close to a Ranger, more so than the rest of these guys sitting by me. But we all sat up there and smiled for 7 months. And we learned that the front of the ship was called the bow, and the back was called the stern. And we learned the difference between an evaporator and a boiler, and all these type things. So that prepared us to go get our ship command. And as I was leaving in the 7 months, it was now time for me to go west again. And as I'm leaving the officer's club on our graduation, I'm going to go to the airport in Providence. I'm going to fly down to D.C. I'm going to meet my wife and our 2 cats, and we're heading west. But I get this call. There's a call for me. Just as I'm walking out the door. So I went back and they said, Captain Myers, we have some bad news for you. I thought, oh boy, something's happened to Mary. No, that wasn't that. The van carrying all our household effects, 17,000 pounds of household effects, had just burned to the ground on the Baltimore Beltway. So we had lost everything. So I arrived down at Washington. I get in the car. We start driving. And I said, Mary, I got something to tell you. Says, what do you have to tell me? I says, we've lost everything. The van burned up today that was carrying our stuff. We have no furniture, no nothing. She looked at me and she said, does that mean that I've lost my desk? I said, that means you've lost your desk. And then she started to cry. So her desk was very important to her. And so we headed west, and the insurance people got a hold of us and said, each day you should take a room and go through the room and tell us all the stuff you lost. So that's what we did going west. And then we got a great big check, and I got to San Diego, went through a couple more schools, went up, took command of Ogden in Long Beach. And about a month later, I deployed for 6 months on Ogden, and I left my wife with a bed, a card table, 2 chairs, a microwave, and 4 plates, and a refrigerator. So that's where, and we were in Navy housing in Long Beach. And when I came back, everything was perfect. Had all the stuff that you'd want in your home. So she went out and did all that stuff while I played games out in the Pacific.
And what kind of a ship was Ogden?
Well, Ogden was a a personnel dock. It carried 800 Marines. That's why they got the personnel. It was called a dock because the back end of it submerged in the water, and you could drive a boat into the ship. So that's how you took the Marines off. You could take them off by boat, or you could take them off on a little flight deck that you had in the back where we could have three helicopters land. And we stored about 150 tanks, Jeeps, Humvees, all that stuff. So we'd load those on the boats and they'd take them all in to shore. Now, I was very fortunate because this was the first time that the Navy was trying to have an urban rescue team. And they picked Ogden to form a team that could go anywhere in the world on Ogden. And we could go into buildings and rescue people and do all this stuff. So I had two SEAL teams and two SEAL platoons, and I had two Marine Recon platoons. And our training for this event was just fantastic. That's all I can tell you. We trained these guys. Give you an example. We went in on a Monday morning, flew in on top of the FBI building in Los Angeles, fast rope down from the helicopters, get down to about 10 floors, capture the FBI director, put him in a helicopter and bring him back to Ogden. And then on one weekend, we went in and took the master of a civilian ship hostage and brought him back just to say that we could do all this stuff. So it was a lot of fun. I mean, they all knew it was going to happen, but it was fun to see it happen.
During this period in our history, now what was going on? You were
85. This was 1987, 88, 89. And it was the year that, in fact, we were deployed when the Myanmar, which some people used to call Burma, had a coup. And we had to go in there, and we took about eight ships up there, and we were going to go in and rescue a whole bunch of Americans. And then the coup folded. So that was our big event during the deployment. But that was the year that the Soviet Union fell. The Berlin Wall fell. And there wasn't a lot of stuff going on, a lot of piracy out in the South China Sea. So we got into a lot of that kind of stuff. And then we came back, and then we had another interesting little mission. And you'll remember when the Exxon Valdez ran aground? We were the Navy ship that went up there to clean that up. So we took 800 civilians out of Anchorage, and we flew them all aboard, and then each morning we would take them down in Prince William Sound and start cleaning up all the fish. And it was really a fantastic time because my chief's mess were all fishermen. So each day they would go out after work was done, after we got everybody back, and they would go out with their little chairs and sit on the fantail and fish. And of course, the fishing up there was absolutely wonderful. I mean, they were pulling salmon in and everything. So they had a great time, just a great time.
So it wasn't the normal Navy rations on that?
No, and I'm glad you brought that up because that is another story that I must share with you. Because we had 800 civilians, we got them up at 8. Got them up at 4 in the morning. We fed them. We put them on boats. We took them somewhere, and they worked from 6 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock at night. Then we brought them back, and we fed them again. The meal they had while they were working was a box lunch, which we prepared and sent with them. So OSHA came up, and they started looking around, and they said, you know, you're not feeding these people enough. You got them out in doing all this work, and the water's cold, and you need to feed them more. So here's the menu. We want you to feed them each night. We want them to have a beef entree, a pasta entree, and a fish entree. We want them to have a choice of five vegetables. We want them to have orange juice, coffee, tea, water, and milk. We want them to have baked bread, which we want you to bake. We want them to have three choice of three desserts. So I said to the guy, you realize that we don't have enough people on this ship to have menus like that. And he said, well, if that's the case, Exxon will get you some more. So Exxon went up and hired the sous chef of the Anchorage Hilton to come down with four of his chefs to help my guys cook. So we did this. I mean, one night you'd have prime rib, shrimp, and lasagna. And the next night you'd have spaghetti, filet mignon, and salmon. I mean, it was meals fit for a king. And of course, all my ship guys got to eat this too. They thought they had died and gone to heaven. I mean, this was just wonderful. But we did all that. And the other part of the story, to show you the difference between how the Navy operates and how the civilian world operates, we found out that we had four pots, big, great big huge pots that we cooked out of. If we wanted to make soup, you know, you'd make soup for 1,500 in one of these big pots. You know, stir it with a shovel and all this kind of stuff. But I only had three that worked. And the fourth one hadn't worked for 15 years because they couldn't get apart. So I told OSHA, I said, I've only got three pots. That's it. I can't make that one work. There's a part that's missing, and I can't get it. And they said, well, we'll get it for you. They got on their satellite telephone. This is before cell phones. This is 89. They called Miami Beach, found a place that could make this part, and in 24 hours, the part was in and the pot was working. And it cost them a whole bunch of money because they only had to make one of these parts. But it worked, and Exxon got the bill. Exxon paid a lot of money for that thing up there.
That's a good story.
So we got to come back, and we were up there for 3 months, and what the Navy did for us, they said, we're going to give you a gift because you did all this, and you did it well. So we got to park in the cruise ship parking mooring spaces down at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco for 7 days, and the crew could just walk off and go to San Francisco and do all that. So it was really very nice. So after Ogden was done, where did I go after Ogden? Oh, I went down to San Diego. Another move. And this move's kind of interesting too. The guy came to quarters in White's Point in San Pedro. And he packed us all out, and now he's coming in, and there's thousands of papers you got to sign, you know, all this inventory stuff. And after we had signed them all, he says, you know, I have to tell you something. And my wife says, well, what, did we do something wrong? I said, no, you didn't do anything wrong. He said, I just happened to have been the driver of the van that burned up with all your stuff in it. He said, I didn't recognize your name, but after I got up here, I recognized your name. So he said, I will guarantee you I will get it to San Diego this time. We both went, it is a small world. And we got to San Diego, and I was the chief of staff for Cruiser Destroyer Group 1. We had all the nuclear cruisers in the Navy. There were about five of them and a couple more and a couple destroyers. And we were the overseer. I was the chief of staff to a two-star admiral. My admiral was Paul Reason, who after that went on to be our first four-star black admiral, first one we'd ever had. And during that tour, we flew our flag on the battleship New Jersey. And when it came in here in 1990 for the Rose Festival, I was the chief of staff. I made that trip in here with New Jersey, of which, if you'll remember, if you were here, we went from 8 hours of visiting to 10 hours to 12 hours to 14, and we still had people lined up all the way to Portland. And when you think that all these people wanted to see the New Jersey, can you imagine what they would like to do when we bring Ranger here, which is much bigger and much more mysterious to the outside eye. After that, I got my last command, or not my last command, my last ship command, which is the USS Peleliu, which was an LHA, and that's a helicopter assault ship. It's a little bit smaller than an aircraft carrier. We carried 55 helicopters and 10 Harrier jump jets. The crew was around 2,000, and we carried 2,200 Marines. And again, the ship was in Long Beach. So we moved back to Long Beach, moved back to White's Point again in San Pedro. The only difference was we lived in a different cul-de-sac. That was the only thing that was different. Very, very interesting quarters. These houses sat up on a hill, looked right down onto the beach, and looked right down out over Santa Catalina. I mean, it was a very well-kept secret. I made a deployment in Peleliu. I went over to Desert Storm, and they rushed me out of Long Beach to get over there for the when Desert Storm, you know, was only about 5 or 6 days long. But before, on my way over there, I had to stop in the Philippines and pick up all the people in the hospital in Cubey Point because they were closing the base because of the Mount Pinatubo volcano had covered the base, so the Navy was moving out. So I went in there and I had to take all the people out of there. Well, the first thing that hit me was as I'm going in to Moore. Yeah, and I'd been to Cuba and Subic many, many times. It was a real dark day, and with all this lava ash, it looked like there was snow on the ground. And you looked out and you said, when I go outside the bridge wing, it's going to be cold. Of course, you go out there and it's 93 degrees. But it looked just almost ominous. It was dark and rainy and all this white stuff. So we loaded all these people aboard. And we're taking in our lines to leave. And we're going to go down to Cebu, the island of Cebu, and put all these people on C-141s and fly them back to Tripler Hospital in Hawaii. It's a one-day trip down there. We hadn't even gotten our lines in, and some guy runs up to the bridge and says, "Captain, guess what? You're a dad." We had had a baby born on the ship, and before, in the 24 hours it took us to go down to Cebu, we had 5 babies born on Peleliu. And all the Marines went up and pitched tents, and they stayed on the flight deck and gave up their staterooms and all their spaces to the families and things like that. It was very nice. Wow. And then we went over and did Desert Storm. And I have some interesting things about Desert Storm. We got in there right at the end of the war. Ranger, by the way, was the carrier that was there, along with Midway, doing all the, when they actually chased the Iraqis out of Kuwait. So the Kuwaitis love Ranger. And we've been talking to them a little bit about Ranger. I think they're going to help us a little bit. But I spent about 12 weeks there after everybody had left. And this is in the middle of the summer. It's 115 degrees. The water temperature in the Persian Gulf is 105 degrees. And I mean, it's with all the air conditioners working properly, the inside of the ship was about 80 degrees. You just couldn't get it any cooler. Just could not get it any cooler because you're sitting in all this hot water that's around the hull. Finally, the three-star, the vice admiral that was in charge over there said, "You know, you guys have been at sea a long, long time. It had been about 80 days before we'd been ashore. So I'm going to send you up to Dubai for a week." Now, when everybody left, all the admirals left, and I was the senior captain of all the ships in the Persian Gulf. So I got a personal from the admiral, and he said, "Now, there's a stipulation here. When you go into Dubai, the first liberty problem that you have, you're all coming back out, and you're never going to ashore again in the Persian Gulf. So I said, wow, this is going to be interesting. We've been at sea for almost 90 days. I've got Marines, I've got sailors, I've got all these people. So I decided that I was going to have the Myers Olympics. And they were going to start every morning at 10 o'clock. And they were going to finish at 2:30 every morning. So people would have to be in Olympics playing sports. They couldn't be in bars. They couldn't be out doing bad things. They had to be playing for their ship. I spent about $5,000 on medals, another $5,000 on trophies. We just played every sport, about 20 sports, and we did this for 7 days. Not one thing went wrong. So I was pretty good. And then we got out of there, and they said, you were so good, we're going to send you down to Abu Dhabi. Now, for a lot of people that might be listening to this this transcript, the United Arab Emirates, there are 7 emirates in the United Arab Emirates. Dubai is one. Abu Dhabi is one. So we went into Abu Dhabi. Abu Dhabi, the Sheikh in Abu Dhabi wants it to look like an American city. And in trying to be like an American city, he has green all over the place. I mean, you go down a street and there are green grass and there are trees. And I mean, it really does look like an American city. So a guy who had helped me with the Olympics came down to Abu Dhabi, and I was having dinner with him. He says, tomorrow we're going to have lunch with somebody that you're going to enjoy meeting. And I says, is it a sheikh? He says, nope, it's not a sheikh. I'm not telling you who it is. You're just going to come. You're going to have a good time. We went out and went to this fancy restaurant. I'm going around the corner, and who is sitting at this table? Muhammad Ali. So we went in there and had lunch with Muhammad Ali, who was a friend of this guy's. And we finally got out of the Persian Gulf and got back, and my tour on Peleliu ended. And at that time, I was a Navy captain with 27 years in the Navy. And what they wanted to do with me is send me back to the Pentagon. They said, if you want to make Admiral, you have to go back to the Pentagon, because you were only there for 6.5 months. And I said, I don't want to go back to the Pentagon. They said, well, then you have two choices. You can either retire or we can find you another job. I said, shoot, you might as well find me another job. How about something teaching? Because I like to teach and I like kids. And so they sent me back to Chicago, and I took over the Chicago Consortium, which was 7 universities. So I had an office at Northwestern, had an office at Illinois Institute of Technology, right down across from Comiskey Park. So I spent 3 years there, and I guess the highlight of that was when I took my softball team for the NROTC playoffs. They let me play, which was good, and we went undefeated and won the softball championship. Now it comes 30 years, and it's time to retire. We're in Chicago. We live on the base up by Great Lakes. And we need to make a decision what we're going to do. Of course, Mary wanted to come immediately back to Oregon. And then I got this high school told me that they wanted me to do a junior ROTC. So I said, well, we'll do this for a couple years and then we'll go to Oregon. But we ended up doing it for 9 years. And then we came to Oregon and we're back here. And I have kept my promise of bringing my wife back to Oregon. And she is very happy back here, loves it. And we live in Lake Oswego, and we are having a good time. We just got 2 new cats. We now have 4 cats. So
would you, looking back, you mentioned the ROTC. Mm-hmm. What would your advice be to young men and women today in high school about the military choices? And you made one that worked out very well, it sounds like. But how would you recommend young people today look at this decision?
There are a couple things. In the 9 years that I taught in the high school, I sent 7 kids to the Naval Academy, and I sent 19 to NROTC scholarships. And I used to try to tell the kids there are about 4 or 5 things in your life that you need to worry about. Number one, you need to be a good citizen. And you need to have the moral values of a good citizen. And when you are tempted to do things that you know are wrong, you have to ignore them. You have to have enough courage to be able to push those aside and get your life going. If the things that you want to do that aren't right, you don't mess with them now. Get going. So that was my first thing. The second thing is that you have to study and you have to have good grades. And if you don't have good grades, there are many options that are not available to you. With good grades, almost all options are available to you. You should try to get into some extracurricular thing. You don't have to be a super jock. You don't have to be on a football team. You don't have to be on a baseball team. You can be a cheerleader. You can be into a thespian club. You can be into the Spanish club. You can be into other things. But get into something that you get good at. You have to have self-esteem. You have to build that up. And if you don't have self-esteem, if you are not interested in you, then other people are not interested in you either. You have to be very interested. And I guess when I taught leadership, which I did for many years, my number one precept on leadership is loyalty. I think you need to be loyal. And if it's the family level, you need to be loyal to your mom and dad. They in turn need to be loyal to you. If you stumble in the road, they need to be able to pick you up and move you on, not give up on you. And you have to be able to look at them and say, this is my mom and dad, and they have done their best to raise me. Now I need to be loyal to them for what they have done to me to get me to this position. So those are the things that are very important. And then you have to look at the last thing. And unfortunately, I hate to even talk about it, but it's money. In the world today, more than when I was a child, when you were a child, money plays a big part in everything that's happening. Because of that, if you go to a college and you pick your dream school, and let's say that dream school is Yale, and you go to Yale, you're going to have a bill at the end of it that's going to take you many, many years to pay off. You'll have a wonderful degree if you study hard again, and you can probably make your way into some high-paying jobs, which will make it easier to pay off your debt. The day that you graduate, you're not guaranteed of a job. Yale doesn't say, come to Yale, and we'll educate you and guarantee that you'll have a job when you walk out of here. They'll help you. They'll try and get you a job. No guarantee. If you go to a service academy, there's a couple things that really play into this. Number one, you will come out of 4 years of a wonderful education. And if you look at U.S. News and World Report, year in and year out, in the top 10 colleges in the United States, you'll always find Air Force Academy, West Point, and the Naval Academy. It's a good education. So you'll come out of that good education, and you won't owe anybody a penny, not one penny. The day you graduate, you are guaranteed that you will have a job. You have 5 years that you have to spend to pay off that. You have to give your country 5 years of your life because your country has paid for you to get a good education. So you have to be willing to do that. And if you're not willing to do that and you're not willing to keep your thought processes open that maybe I want to stay beyond 5 years. I don't know until I get to that point. If the day you go in a Naval Academy or West Point or the Air Force Academy, you say, all right, I'm staying for 5 years. That's it. I'm out of here. If that's the attitude, then you shouldn't go. Because the American taxpayer doesn't want you to have that attitude. And it's not fair to them. And it's really not fair to you because you have closed your mind on what could happen to you as you grow. So those are the things that I would tell young people.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Tim. We've enjoyed this time with you and the advice you offer.